We are joined here live in the studios by Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a partial wrap-up of last week's news, also a wrap-up of the last year's news, and look forward into Maria's predictions for 2020.
Yeah.
Crystal ball.
Happy New Year, by the way.
Yes. Happy New Year. Officially, what day in January do we get to stop saying Happy New Year?
I think about today.
Okay.
Yes.
So, surprisingly, a lot happened this week, and there are events
The reasons that we started doing these year-end wrap-ups each year is that the holiday season, there was very little news. That's not the reality any longer.
Yeah.
But
we
wanted to mention right at the top, in case people have some time free this afternoon, there will be today's a day of national protests against the possibility of war with Iran, and that rally and I think march in Seattle will be at 2 o'clock, so about an hour from now, downtown at Victor Steinbrück Park, north end of Pike Place Market, western in Virginia. So head on down there if you have a chance, and disrupt things.
Fire up the car.
Send a message.
And bus and hover bubble.
Yep, absolutely.
Hover bubble. All right. Bicycle, however you want to get there.
Yep.
And I did want to do a quick note that last Sunday, a longtime local activist, Judith Kulikoff, passed away.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, I saw that online. So she was the one issue I know for sure she was super active in was Palestinian rights. She had been on the show Mind Over Matters multiple times, had lined up guests and had clued us into talks, different people coming through town. So, and I guess just from a brief talking to her before doing an interview, I mean, she'd been doing activism for a long time. And she's a classic example of one of those people that like has worked on numerous issues that I had intended to like interview, you know, with a good in-depth interview and never got around to it. So
There's a lot of folks out there who've worked on multiple issues, who have been activists for decades, who are just, they're key behind the scenes people. And I think we tend to forget that those folks exist sometimes. We focus on the superstars, the people who get their names out there, who are self-promoters, and we don't think about the folks who are not self-promoters. They promote the issues, and they promote others and speakers who come to town, and they just work really hard to advance progressive issues.
The real building blocks in our activist community.
And there's a lot of them out there.
There are. And I'm going to try and do a better job of getting them before the microphone so that they can share their thoughts.
Or just covering their issues, because that's what's important to them.
And their experiences over the years, because there's a lot that younger activists can learn from.
A lot of knowledge there.
Wealth of experience.
And wisdom, Hear that.
Yeah.
All right, so jumping into this week, we're going to be getting back to you in just a second, Job, but right before that, we wanted to touch on a local issue.
I wanted to touch on the new city council committees. City Council.
They were announced this week.
Yeah, the City Council is going to be talking on Monday and voting on the setup for the new committees on our new progressive City Council. And it raises the question: Will the new progressive majority matter, given the way the new City Council committees are set up? I just wanted to talk about who was going to be chairing which committees. There are 8 committees rather than 9. Alex Peterson. And I want to just point out that some of the more powerful committees are going to be chaired by a couple of the more conservative council members. One of those is Alex Peterson, is going to be chairing the Transportation and Utilities Committee. He opposed the Move Seattle levy in 2015 and the Sound Transit 3 light rail expansion in 2016. So Peterson is not a big fan necessarily of transit and multimodal transportation.
His former boss for a lot of those years was Tim Burgess.
Yeah. Now, he also opposed the 35th Avenue Northeast bike lane, and he thinks that homeowners should be allowed to bargain with the city over where bike lanes and traffic safety improvements are situated. So he's not a big fan necessarily of building out the bicycle master plan as Mike O'Brien was. Now, the vice chair on his committee is Mike O'Brien's replacement, Dan Strauss from District 6. Strauss said that he's an advocate for dedicated bus lanes and bike lanes. However, Strauss was an advisor to Sally Bagshaw. That's his prior experience, and he advised her on transportation issues and land use planning issues. So I'm not exactly convinced that the combination of Peterson and Strauss will be good for pushing Seattle to a more environmentally sustainable transportation system. Now, the other members of that committee are Lorena Gonzalez, Lisa Herbold, and Tammy Morales. And I want to point out, too, that these new rules for the setup for city council committees mean that rather than three or four members of a committee, there are five. You need a quorum in order to hold a committee meeting. So you can't just have one or two people hold a committee meeting and vote to move legislation along, as we've seen in the past. And other city council members can't just come in and decide to sit in on a committee and vote. They can sit and they can listen to the committee's business, but they can't vote if they're not on the committee. So those are new changes.
That's a dramatic change.
Those are big changes.
Because a lot of the more contentious issues before city council, you'd go to the committee meetings and you'd see all nine city council members.
On some committees, but not now. So what's interesting with this Transportation Utilities Committee is it's got Alex Peterson and Dan Strauss will be the chair and vice chair. The other members, Gonzalez, Herbold and Morales would probably support more progressive, more environmentally sustainable forms of transportation. But Gonzalez will be the swing vote. And she often will defer to whoever the chair and vice chair is because they've done more homework than she has. She's not necessarily a person to shake things up. So that's why I'm concerned about that committee. The other couple of committees, Deborah Juarez will continue to chair the Public Assets and Native Communities Committee, which is not changing a whole lot. That's so that she can stay on top of the waterfront redevelopment plan, which I'm viewing as a lot of giveaways to real estate developers, and the Key Arena redevelopment, again, which is, and of course, she would also oversee any new stadium construction, for example, if a new basketball team comes to Seattle. Her vice chair in that committee is Alex Peterson, again, a conservative member of the city council. The other members of that committee are Lisa Herbold, Teresa Mosqueda, and Shama Sawant. And those three may be able to put the brakes on some of Juarez and Peterson's very pro-business, pro-developer agenda, but maybe not. Now, the third committee I'm concerned about is Dan Strauss chairing the Land Use and Neighborhoods Committee. As I said, he was an advisor to Sally Bagshaw on transportation and land use issues, so there you go. Mosqueda is his vice chair. And the other members of that committee are Deborah Juarez, Andrew Lewis, and Alex Peterson. So again, there you could have a more conservative majority on that committee if Dan Strauss and Alex Peterson and Deborah Juarez get together and decide what land use and zoning changes the city will have to accept. Now, the other committees, Teresa Mosqueda is going to be chairing, and Lisa Herbold will be vice chair of the Finance and Housing Committee. That committee is a big one. It's going to be in charge of the budget, as well as housing policies and the Office of Labor Standards. So having Teresa Mosqueda as the chair of that committee and Lisa Herbold as the vice chair is pretty good news. Now, the other members of that committee are Lorena Gonzalez, Andrew Lewis, and Dan Strauss. So I think that we're going to see some big changes in terms of the city budget and perhaps housing policies with the composition of that committee. The other good news is Lisa Herbold will chair and Lorena Gonzalez will vice chair the Public Safety and Human Services Committee. That's a huge committee, very powerful. It's going to oversee the police reform process, youth justice programs, including negotiations on the youth jail, And the LEAD program and other diversion programs, public health programs, including the city's response to the opioid epidemic and potentially citing a harm reduction clinic and services within the city of Seattle. And they'll oversee the navigation team as well as the human services department, whatever's left of homelessness services, which is, of course, the navigation team. And I find it kind of interesting that this is now combined in one city council committee along with public safety, which is the police department. It's almost like it's saying, yes, we know the navigation team is really part of the police department, not part of the human services department. Now, the other members of that committee, in addition to Lisa Herbold as the chair and Gonzalez as the vice chair, are Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, and Shama Sawant. So again, a progressive majority on that committee. So that's going to be very, very interesting. And I want to point out, too, Lorena Gonzalez was the chair of this of the Public Safety Committee last year. So she'll be carrying forward her work on that committee into rolling it into this new committee. But we'll see with Lisa Herbold and a progressive majority if they can push Mayor Durkan to push for a Seattle Police Officers Guild contract that will contain more police reforms that the city council passed in their police reform legislation a couple years ago than the current proposed contract. As for the other committees, Sawant will still be chair of a stripped-down Sustainability and Renters' Rights Committee, which will meet once a month. And it'll be interesting to see if she can get rent control passed on the city council and maybe more bills related to the Green New Deal for Seattle. Her vice chair is Tammy Morales, and other members of that committee are Deborah Juarez, Andrew Lewis, and Alex Peterson. I'm sure Lewis, Juarez, and Peterson are meant to hold Sawant and Morales in check on that committee. We'll see how things shake out there. Tammy Morales is going to be chair of the Tiny Community Economic Development Committee. That's a catch-all for some miscellaneous items in the city budget, in the city government, including the Office of Economic Development, their equitable development programs, civil rights programs and issues, and arts and culture. The vice chair of that committee is Andrew Lewis, and when he was running for District 7, he said that arts and culture was going to be one of his one of the things he'd like to concentrate on when he's on the city council. Other members of that committee are Deborah Juarez, Alex Peterson, and Shama Sawant. And then Lorena Gonzalez opted to kick back this time since she is going to be city council president. Her committee is she will chair the Governance and Education Committee, and I think maybe to prepare herself to run for higher office. The Governance Committee is where the city council interfaces with other governmental entities in Washington State, including the state legislature and other cities and counties. Now, Deborah Juarez is her vice chair, and the other members of that committee are Mosqueda, Sawant, and Strauss. Andrew Lewis was sort of tossed the leftovers in a way.
Yeah, he was. He's the first council member in memory that is coming in and that is not chairing a committee, standing committee.
Well, not of a standing committee, but he will chair the Select Committee on Homelessness, which may not have a whole lot to do within the city of Seattle once the regional authority gets up and running, but it's going to have a big job overseeing the transition to the regional authority. And I'm guessing he's going to opt to sit on the governing board of the regional authority.
He's been designated as the liaison to that body.
To that body, yeah. And that body is going to have Mayor Durkan on it, and it's going to have two city council members. So he's obviously going to be one of them. And that could keep him pretty busy. And some folks may view that as a thankless job, but I know that that was one of the issues he ran on in District 7, too, was housing affordability and homelessness. So that's the composition of the committees and some major changes in how the committees operate. And it'll be interesting to see. There's a few committees where the progressive majority may have some real pull, the budget committee, for example, and the office and the housing policies. And in particular, issues with police accountability, the youth jail, and Human Services Department. It'll be interesting to see if in that in that combined Public Safety and Human Services Committee, if Herbold butts up against, Herbold and the other progressive members butt up against Mayor Durkin and her permanent interim director of the Human Services Department, yeah. Jason Johnson.
Yeah, HSD is a mess right now.
Yeah.
And the city council really does need to step in there and ensure that the city's policies are helping the homelessness. Right now, they're just making things worse.
Well, and helping other folks who should be helped through the Human Services Department, like folks who are aging, low-income seniors, youth, and issues with youth incarceration versus youth diversion. That's going to be a big deal coming up in the next year or so.
Yeah.
And other folks who rely on the Human Services Department as well.
All right. So jumping, the last couple of weeks had been doing a wrap up of the overhyped and underreported stories for the year. And Jav, you didn't get a chance last week to weigh in on that. And
yeah. Well, I'm going to defer to the list that Maria went through last week because it's a very good list. But I had a few others because it was a busy year, things that were underreported because, quite frankly, Donald Trump's is a media fire hose, and a lot of important stories got buried behind all the Trump scandals and whatever he's tweeting on a given day.
Job's been focusing more on the national, international news than I have. I've been focusing more on the local. So take it away.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about was the collapse of the National Rifle Association, which has for decades been considered one of the most powerful lobbies in D.C., and something that politicians of both parties feared incurring the wrath of. That's no longer true. The NRA is embroiled in its own scandals. It's also embroiled in an investigation by the New York State Attorney General's office that may wind up in the revocation of its charter because among those scandals have been violations of nonprofit law where executives of the NRA were lavishing themselves with gifts, shall we say, out of donors' money, and that's illegal. So that was a big story, and it kind of got buried. And of course, the role of the NRA in the 2016 election, apparently funneling money from Russian oligarchs to the Trump campaign via the NRA's PAC, that also is illegal, and that also may wind up in the revocation of their charter. Speaking of things that got shut down for years and years of violating nonprofit law, the Trump Foundation was shut down by the New York State Attorney General's office this past year. And in any other year and with any other president, the idea that not only a president but all the immediate members of his family were told by a judge never to sit on the board of a foundation again. The judge basically found that the Trump Foundation was a years-long scam that most recently was used to funnel money again to the Trump campaign. One of the other things that should have gotten more attention than it did was the revelation of Stephen Miller, the architect of the administration's immigration policies, his white supremacist roots, and the fact that a number of emails were uncovered.
And his continuing ties to white supremacist groups and ideology.
Yeah, a number of emails surface from his time as a legislative aide to Senator Jeff Sessions, who went on to become Trump's favorite attorney general, where he kept pitching these stories to Breitbart News from white supremacist websites and treating this as credible information when it absolutely was not. And it really shows what the ideological underpinnings of the Trump administration's immigration approach is. It's white supremacy. It's trying to keep brown people out of the United States. And
it's racism.
It's racist. It's extremely racist. And it's the kind of human rights violations that we've seen, things like the child separation policy, putting kids in cages, basically through executive fiat, abolishing the United States asylum program. And these are
and essentially hijacking the internal security apparatus of the United States. and that, like, for example, the Department of Homeland Security to focus strictly on immigration on a racist agenda rather than dealing with what the Department of Homeland Security was set up for, which is terrorism, and I would argue the threat of domestic terrorism in particular.
Yeah. It's, well, and we saw also, for instance, the deployment of the military on the border for no other reason than
exactly.
to help Trump try and gin up fear ahead of the 2018 election. You know, that
and
that
to pursue his racist agenda of putting a wall in place between us and our brown neighbors to the south.
Exactly. And, you know, the other
us
thing
being white Americans.
Yes. And the other thing I would argue is undercovered is the enormous human rights catastrophe that that has caused on the other side of the border as people wait to try and get into the United States that historically would be have been housed here, particularly with relatives already in the U.S. Instead, they're in these squalid camps on the other side of the border that are getting preyed upon by drug cartels and other criminal elements. Mm-hmm. And these are desperate people. They're fleeing drought and climate change and repressive regimes in Central America that we helped install.
Which the U.S. has supported, yes.
Yeah. So that really needs more attention than it has gotten in the last year. And although these obviously got plenty of attention during the time in which they were current, I would argue that both Michael Cohen's testimony to Congress and also Robert Mueller's congressional testimony have pretty much fallen down the memory hole after they happened, because both of them contained compelling evidence of criminal activity by the President of the United States, and that should have been a much bigger deal than it was. Republicans having become a cult of personality that will excuse any behavior by Donald Trump as long as it helps keep Republicans in power, which I would argue is maybe a short-term beneficial strategy, but not long-term, because they're going to pay for that in the elections, assuming we have free and fair elections in this coming year.
Yeah,
and that's one of the coming stories for the year.
And it shows that corruption is not just a feature of other governments, it's also a feature of our own government.
No, there's nothing special about the human beings that are at the highest levels of the government of the United States in terms of being corruptible compared to other countries.
Yeah.
Our institutions aren't necessarily up to the task of accommodating someone like Trump, whose presidency is inherently corrupt. And we, you know, there obviously is the impeachment underway. But in terms of accountability, we'll see what happens next November, because I don't think we're going to get any accountability before that.
Yeah.
And goodness knows what's going to happen between now and then, as we saw this week. I would say other things that were underreported, there was remarkably little follow-up to the ongoing devastation in Puerto Rico from Hurricane Maria. That was 3 years ago now. And this past year in the Bahamas as well with Hurricane Dorian. Those were huge, hugely devastating damages that the United States has done very little to help with. And in the case of Puerto Rico, those are American citizens. And, you know, much of the island is still without reliable power as a result of that. And the Trump administration has withheld congressionally approved aid to Puerto Rico because there's too many brown people there.
Yeah. I talked about that a little bit in my story, underreported stories last year, how the Trump administration has sat on money meant to help with natural disasters.
Yeah.
But I think it goes deeper than that. It also involves corruption within FEMA and the Trump administration in terms
yep.
of who they select as contractors and how the money is spent, where it's spent, and who it's meant to benefit.
Yeah, and who it doesn't wind up benefiting.
Yeah, who it doesn't wind up benefiting.
A couple of other international stories that I thought were underreported. Obviously, the Amazon fires were a huge story, but the huge fires in Siberia were not. And I don't really understand that, because that, in terms of the risk to climate change, was just as important. And, of course, we're seeing now this is the new normal with what's been going on in Australia this past few weeks, and particularly this week. Sydney had a high today of 120 degrees, which was an all-time record for them, and a lot more fire devastation in Australia
yeah.
today.
And I was talking to Jav and Mike before the beginning of the show, too. I'd read Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, where he talks about historical and, in fact, ancient civilizations that were possibly overthrown not through wars or human migration, but through environmental collapse.
Yeah.
And he had, as the final chapter of his book, he was talking about modern civilization and climate change. And Australia was one of the places that he pinpointed as a place that is uniquely vulnerable to the first effects of major climate change because of the dryness of Australia. And it's always on the verge of drought. And now we're seeing chronic drought there. And with the chronic drought and the extreme heat, we're getting enormous apocalyptic forest fires.
Yeah, and high winds also.
Yeah, and the complete, and those fires are not just burning, you know, brush or burning trees. It's burning human infrastructure. It's burning things that could potentially allow the land to recover after a fire. All of that is burning because,
like, all the animals that happen to live in that same area.
Yeah. Typically, with a normal fire, what you would think of as a normal fire, you know, the tops of trees burn, and there's, you know, maybe some dry brush burns, and there's recovery in the years afterwards. But temperatures can get so hot, and these fires can get so extreme and devastating that sometimes that all of the things that would allow a forest or a brushlands area to recover are burnt. And that's what we're starting to see with these almost apocalyptic fires.
Yeah. One of the other things that was striking with Jared Diamond's book, which is we're seeing play out in real time now, mm-hmm. is with all of those ancient civilizations that collapsed for environmental reasons, the ruling elites of those civilizations thought they could insulate themselves from the effects of it. And, of course, they were able to do that for a little bit of time, but that doesn't work.
No.
And we're seeing that now, too.
Yeah, I would agree.
But this time they have spaceships.
No, you can leave. I mean, research on the effects of space on the human body show that you can leave the planet, but it's going to have an effect on you a lot faster than you think. And long-term survival of the human race in space is still decades away.
Yeah.
If at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was joking.
Yeah. Anyway, but you know, not. You can joke, but there are people out there who think that way, who think, no, we can go to space if we need to.
Local resident Jeff Bezos, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
They can. They just, it's going to be a much shorter trip than they thought.
Yeah, they can, but their survival is not guaranteed. And in fact, it's not likely at this point.
Yeah.
So. All right.
But anything to get away from the rabble.
Yes.
So any other items there that you wanted to jump in?
No, we can, we should
jump
probably
back to reality.
Yeah. Well, nothing happened this week, really.
No, we can jump back, to, the stories that we expect to see in 2020. And I can talk a little bit about local. And
okay. Then. Before we do that, mm-hmm. let's, touch on the, what happened in Iraq this
year? Yeah, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. He was a widely revered figure throughout the Middle East, not just in Iran. And, you know, the kind of descriptions that you've been seeing from, you know, senior Democrats, that this is incredibly reckless, and national security experts, they're right, it is. And there's really no predicting how this is going to go. But we do know who the big winners out of that assassination are. They are ISIS. This is a jihadist recruiting wet dream, honestly. Saudi Arabia, and we're seeing that already with a spike in the price of oil. And, of course, Saudi Arabia is the major regional
rival
of Iran. Iran and Iraq are majority Shiite.
It's important to remember, too, that the current Iraqi government is very closely aligned to Iran because it's majority Shiite.
Yes.
And many of the Shiite blocs in the Iraqi parliament have close ties to Iran. We tend to forget here in the United States that the Iraqi government is not staffed solely by Iraqis who were exiled to the United States during the Saddam Hussein regime. Many of those folks who were in exile during the Saddam Hussein regime from Iraq lived in Iran. And they moved back to Iraq and have become a major influence within the Iraqi government. That gives the U.S. Security state nightmares, but that's the truth.
Yeah, and I think it's very likely that you're going to wind up seeing the Iraqi government request the expelling American troops from Iraq.
That's what we saw a lot of this week in Iraq.
And, you know, that alliance is probably doomed at this point. Just as Trump left the Kurds out to dry, he's now doing that with the Iraqis.
So rather than walking the tightrope of a U.S.-Iraqi alliance and trying to maintain a connection there, Trump is burning the bridge.
Absolutely.
Essentially, that Obama walked pretty well, I think.
And the other big winner, of course, and this will come as a great shock to both of you, is Russia. Not only because the spike in oil prices.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. The spike in oil prices. But it also means that the regime of Assad in Syria is almost solely dependent on Russia right now. They had been getting a lot of support also from Soleimani and the Quds forces from Iran.
Yeah, and Iran has a pretty close connection to the Russian government as well. The Russian government has supported Iran through the U.S. sanctions.
Yes. So it's not surprising to try and figure out who the winners and losers are in all this. I wish we had a president that with important national security matters, I could trust that he wasn't lying, but I don't think Trump knows how not to lie. So the assurances of the U.S. government that this was a defensive measure without any proof can't really be taken at face value, honestly, because there's no proof. And there's no legal justification otherwise.
Well, they've promised to release proof next week, but we'll see.
Yeah.
We've heard a lot of promises in the past without any follow through.
Yeah. It might take them that long to you know,
come up with something
to print up the documents.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the other thing that was really kind of shocking about this, and this was kind of buried in a New York Times article yesterday, like about the 40th paragraph or something, was a quote from an administration official that they really hadn't thought through what would happen after the assassination. And this is a hallmark of the Trump administration's foreign policy. It's very impulsive. It doesn't game out what might happen. But it left the United States scrambling to protect diplomats and to protect military deployments all over the world in the aftermath of this, because they're all in danger right now. Because the MO of Iran over the years has been to support local militias in different parts of the world that can carry out missions that Iran wants. And of course, Iran wants revenge at this point, very much so, at the highest levels of their government. The other risk that the United States is incurring here that really hasn't gotten a lot of attention this week is the risk of cyber attack. Iran has one of the best cyber capabilities in the world at this point. One of the reasons they do is something that American media doesn't really like to discuss, which is called Stuxnet, which was the virus developed by the CIA circa 2005.
With Israeli help as well.
Yes, with Israeli help, that was meant to infect the Iranian nuclear program, but wound up going viral and doing a lot of damage all over the world, which is why we know it exists. But it's the first known example of a nation state using cyber warfare as a first strike weapon against another nation state. That was the United States that did it to Iran, and Iran has not forgotten. So we are very much at risk of cyber attacks and that kind of disruption as Iran considers how it wants to respond.
And as I said earlier, the current Department of Homeland Security is not focused on that kind of thing. They're not focused in how to protect U.S. infrastructure against cyber attack by a foreign government. They're focused instead on carrying out Trump's immigration policies.
Yeah, and we know of at least three, maybe four countries that have the capacity right now to attack American infrastructure. China does. Russia does. We've seen that. Iran does, and potentially North Korea does as well. So it's going to be an interesting year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, and it was also, I thought the assassination was very, very nicely timed in the evening before Congress reconvened so that impeachment went right off the headlines of the paper. Mm-hmm. Not like Trump has ever, tried to do or say something outrageous to distract from bad headlines. But this is going to have very long-term effects.
Mm-hmm. All right. So looking forward into
happy 2020.
Happy 2020.
Developing for this coming year. Did Maria? You had some.
Some local stories.
And my list was almost exactly the same as Maria's. So.
Yeah, some local stories. I already talked a little bit about whether the progressive majority on the city council will have much impact. My guess is that they will have some impact, but that the conservatives on city council are building up a beachhead against them. My number two local story is, will the Regional Homelessness Authority make a difference in housing King County's massive homeless population? We're going to be having another one-night count here pretty soon on Friday, January 24th. So we'll see if the Durkin administration's policies, including their continuous sweeps, are working to get people off the street, or if they're just getting those homeless folks are just getting pushed out to the suburbs. Meanwhile, the question arises is, will those suburban representatives on the Regional Homelessness Authority governing board veto the kinds of programs that could really make a difference in housing homeless people? And who else besides Andrew Lewis and Mayor Jenny Durkin are going to be representing Seattle and Seattle's interests on the governing board of the new regional authority? And will Lewis be a scrappy fighter? Or my guess is he's a really smooth talker and he's really good at shaking hands. And sometimes there's a need for a schmoozer who can build consensus. And we're just going to have to see if that is what he does on the Regional Homelessness Authority Governing Board, and if that has some effect in getting across the policies that will help house people.
Yeah, and I'm old enough to remember way back in 2018 when the argument against the employee head tax was, well, Seattle shouldn't be going it alone. We should be doing a regional approach. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we have at least the infrastructure supposedly in place to do a regional approach. So now where's the housing going to come from? And who's going to get taxed to pay for it? Because there really is no body of money that is available to tax other than big businesses, which both Seattle and the state of Washington have historically let slide without really, asking to pay their fair share to help the community.
Yeah.
And I don't have the numbers, but I did see that December of this last year just was a record year for commercial property sales for developers and stuff. I mean, it just blew away any previous records. So,
yeah, and
so there's wealth there, obviously, as we all know.
I've been reading the Daily Journal of Commerce occasionally, and it's dominated by news of property purchases and property sales for record amounts. Sometimes property that was purchased just a few years ago is selling for double what the owners paid for it. So, yeah, real estate speculation is what it is. Real estate speculation is one of the main drivers of our economic growth here in Seattle. So the question arises is, what are the city's next steps and how can the city profit from some of that growth without putting a stake in its heart?
And we also don't know how much of that growth is being driven by foreign interests and foreign money coming into the U.S. and coming into
Seattle.
Because
a lot of it's LLCs that that buy and sell this property, and the ownership is not transparent there.
The ownership is not transparent, and the King County Assessor, which does have some of that information, has refused to make it public.
Yeah.
But there's a national case that in the last few weeks was put before, I want to say it's in Kansas, that they are challenging the national entity that has all the records on this, that just hasn't been forthcoming with the data, but they have been collecting the data on foreign purchases of U.S. properties. And I know that Aaron Glantz, who writes for Reveal, was part of the team that took that to, I want to say it's their Supreme Court or the equivalent of the federal court for
in Kansas.
Kansas. Mm-hmm. So potentially that information or some cracking open the mysteries there could be forthcoming late in the year,
But, and we'll see if that applies just in the state of Kansas or if that's
I think it's
nationwide.
It's a national push. They're just challenging it. Yeah, they're just challenging it in that particular spot.
And I would take a wild guess that we have a lot more foreign investment here than we do in Kansas.
Oh, yeah, than in Kansas.
Yeah, yeah. It's major cities. There had just been a report out of both Seattle and in the Boston area as to the number of international purchases here locally and in Boston. So, again, there's a lot of interest in that across the United States, and Seattle is on the forefront of that.
Yeah. Now, also on my list, number three is, will the city get out from under court-mandated police reform, or will Judge Robart declare Seattle fully out of compliance? He's set to make a decision here on the current Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. And we'll just have to see what decision gets made. But that's just the current contract, which is set to expire very soon. And negotiations are going to be starting here very soon on the next contract. We'll just have to see if Lisa Herbold can push for a better contract than Lorena Gonzalez and Mayor Jenny Durkin negotiated.
I would say also that... Anticipating Judge Robart's ruling probably early this year. Almost everything that he's said about the current proposed police contract is that it's out of compliance.
Yeah.
And almost everything that the city has said in arguing that it's not has not addressed his concerns.
Yeah.
So I think that's likely to go against the city.
Yeah. And as I've said in the last couple weeks, Mayor Durkin has been stalling. In terms of complying with the court's order that the city either renegotiate the contract or come up with some steps to make changes to the contract, she instead hired a consulting firm, which has, they released their report in December and pretty much said that they agreed with the Community Police Commission's assessment of the contract, that it's not a good one, that it's not in compliance. So we'll just have to see.
Which is not the outcome that Durkin was hoping for.
No, not the outcome Durkin was hoping for. So we'll see what the judge says.
So I think she'll probably hire another set of consultants.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And ask for her money back from the first.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And write into the contract this time what the results are supposed to be.
I think she's been stalling because she's been hoping that the Trump Department of Justice just kind of drops it and eventually the court just drops it as well. But I'm not convinced that Donald Trump will get reelected.
I'm not convinced that Judge Robart is going to, of his own volition, just walk away from it.
Just going to walk away from it, yeah. Okay. So we'll see what happens this year. Now, also on my list, local tax reform. It's a good question of whether the state Supreme Court will uphold Seattle's wealth tax. And will the city find other new revenue sources for priorities like affordable housing and energy conversion and transportation infrastructure, things that we need a lot of money in order to fund. I think this is a question of whether the city is going to jump the gun again and pass a full-on progressive income tax before the state legislature tries it. I don't see the state legislature trying it in this upcoming session.
No, I don't either.
But I also want to say that Sawant and other local progressives are looking at a ballot initiative for a business version of the wealth tax that will target large corporations like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, et cetera. So that's something we can look forward to in the coming year. Something similar to the head tax, maybe not exactly the same, that will raise revenue for things like affordable housing.
And while I'm not expecting any kind of major structural tax reform at the state level, it is going to be a very interesting legislative session.
It is.
Particularly because Frank Chopp is retired as Speaker, and he was basically the roadblock to a lot of progressive legislation last year. So the Democrats have solidified their hold on the state legislature. Obviously, Jay Inslee is still in the governor's seat, having had an abortive run for president that did raise his profile as an advocate for climate change. So I think there's going to be a real push for some sort of carbon tax type legislation. I don't know that it'll be successful, but I think there'll be a push.
Yeah. on my list. We talked about housing affordability. I was thinking in terms of what are the city's next steps to keep its working class residents housed and to keep small locally owned businesses in the city. So Sawant, of course, is focused on rent control. There are a lot of ways to structure a really good rent control bill, but the state legislature will have to repeal the statewide ban before any Seattle bill can actually take effect. And I'm not seeing a movement for that in the state legislature with the long list of bills that have been pre-filed. It looks like the city council might have other things that it could do. One is looking at, as I said, ways to deal with gentrification that don't put a stake in the heart of our economic growth. And there are a lot of solutions that the city council could consider, things like more publicly owned housing, land trusts, co-op housing, rental caps and subsidies, public grants to remodel older buildings to keep those units affordable, new land use policies that protect certain neighborhoods from gentrification, although I did talk about the land use committee being dominated by the more conservative city council members. Expedited construction permits for buildings with affordable units, with a high percentage of affordable units, things like that. There are all kinds of things the city council could focus on and hopefully will focus on in the coming year.
The city has invested much more heavily in urban land trusts in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we'll definitely see that, because there seems to be a consensus around that as a constructive model.
Yeah. Now, also on my list is orcas, salmon, and dams. The state has to abide by recent court decisions to restore fish passage that was blocked by road construction. But where will the money come from? That's one of the things that the state legislature has to tackle this coming year. In addition, drastic declines in salmon and steelhead runs and the resulting decline in the whale population of Puget Sound point to our region's most critical environmental issue, which is removing dams and restoring the state's wild fish habitat. The need is now urgent, with 20 separate salmon and steelhead runs on the brink of extinction, as is the J-pod of orcas that live in the Puget Sound region.
And this is something that science has been telling us for 20 years is necessary.
Yeah, and it's just really come to a critical point.
Yeah,
right.
And whether there's the political will.
Yeah, whether there's the political will, whether the Democratic majority can actually pass some major changes in the state legislature. Last year, the conservative Democrats and Republicans put a halt on real major changes. But Governor Inslee ran as the climate change candidate, and he needs to really push and really get the Democratic majority to push some major changes that will take down dams along the Snake River.
And they have posted a online survey, which I put on my Facebook page, but we'll put it on the KODX page as well, mm-hmm. for people's feedback on removal of the lower Snake River dams. So I think just setting themselves up with a little support maybe for whatever decision they end up going with, which will override whatever the heck we want. But
yeah, that's a good start. That can't be the only thing, though.
Oh, I agree.
Other things like changing the states.
They already did the blue ribbon panel, though, so I guess this is the next thing after that.
Changing the state's emphasis and all the money that they pour into, for example, fish hatcheries, to putting that money into restoring wild habitat and wild fish runs is another critical area that needs emphasis.
Yeah, and we've seen the last couple of years how destructive the fish hatcheries can be.
And how restoring rivers and dam removal has benefited the environment dramatically.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's very clear.
There's no question that restoring the habitat means restoring the run, because the fish return. They don't know why. You know, runs that were deemed extinct return.
And bounce back.
You know, you bring the habitat back and they come back. The fish return. So that's something that the state legislature really has to focus on. That, and also, I think, regulating and eventually doing away with fish farming in Puget Sound and in Puget Sound area rivers will really help as well.
And also the estuary around Pacific County and Grays Harbor.
Yeah.
There's a lot down there, too.
Yeah. So also on my list, what about that Green New Deal that the city of Seattle passed, can we get it passed at in the state of Washington as a whole? That's a much heavier lift with the state legislature. Like I say, those conservative Democrats in the suburbs and in rural areas, they're not for it as much as the urban Democrats are. But like I say, we've got the climate change guy as our governor, and if he cracks the whip, he could get the Democrats to line up and pass something similar to a Green New Deal in the state of Washington.
Yeah, I'm sure they will not call it that for political reasons, but hopefully they can get at least some important elements of the Green New Deal passed.
Yeah, in particular, I'm looking at transportation. Now, transportation is kind of the Achilles heel for the state Democrats, because as I've said, those conservative Democrats in the suburbs and in rural areas tend to side with the Republicans when it comes to making the transportation bill a road-heavy bill, primarily road maintenance and road construction rather than transit, bikes, multimodal, and conversion to electric vehicle infrastructure.
And something else that's going to have a huge impact on this year, which we'll find out pretty soon, I think, is how the courts rule on the constitutionality of 976. Mm-hmm. Because if that is upheld, it's going to put a gaping hole in the state's public transportation and road infrastructure bill, budgets.
So that's something that the state legislature is going to have to really tackle hard in this upcoming legislative session, is what to do about the transportation budget. And in particular, there's that emphasis that the Democrats need to put in there on green energy and green aspects of a transportation budget, because transportation is still the leading source of climate change emissions, of carbon emissions in the state of Washington.
And hopefully they know enough to package it in job creation, because if you do a bill like that right, it does create a lot of jobs.
It does, yeah. And then last on my list for local is for local stories that are coming up are in the state legislature as well as in the city. We're going to see bills that relate to facial recognition technology and digital surveillance. Those are hot button issues, and they bear a very strong emphasis on and a very strong impact on people's privacy, the privacy of your data, but also the privacy of your ability to move in the public space without being tracked by the government and tracked by major corporations. Facial recognition technology directly impacts that.
And that's also comes back to police accountability.
It does.
Because particularly with SPD, we've seen where they've embraced that kind of technology without even notifying the city council, let alone having any kind of accountability for it.
So this next year, I think we're going to see definitely the state legislators are already working on a bill that's a carryover from the last legislative session last year that would regulate facial recognition technology, and that bill has a lot of loopholes in it. So keep a close eye on that and make sure that you comment on that bill when it's up before the state legislature. And the city council is trying to get information from the city government on facial recognition and digital surveillance technologies. So
which they've been working on for years.
Yeah, which they've also been working on for years. But the longer we go without a bill that's been debated in public, that's a good, strong one that ensures the privacy of Seattle residents, the longer we go without that bill, the more wide open the door is for the Seattle Police Department and the city government to actually use those technologies without oversight by the city council. So expect that
to be a big issue. Disturb anyone.
Yeah, so that should be a big issue in the coming year.
All right.
So those are my local ones. I had a few national ones too.
We got time for that. We've got 6 whole minutes. And
yeah.
you had like half a dozen events though, right?
I did. I had about 6 or 7 events. But
so maybe 4 or 5 minutes worth of.
We could talk about the first two on my list of national. Number one is the Democratic presidential primaries. February and March will be the key months to see which candidates survive in a field that hasn't narrowed that much in the Democratic race. Sanders, Biden, Buttigieg, Warren, Yang, Klobuchar, and the two billionaires in the race, Steyer and Bloomberg, they're all raking in enough money to really keep campaigning.
Yeah, I think those folks, and maybe Cory Booker will be viable throughout Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
And the Washington State's primary is only a week after.
It's only a week after Super Tuesday. Yeah.
So we may have more than two people to choose from this time.
But things are. I think it may narrow a little bit because we've got Iowa on February 3rd, New Hampshire 11 days, you know, a week later, and then 11 days later, Nevada. And then again on February 29th, is South Carolina. Then that's Super Tuesday on March 3rd with 15 states, including California, Colorado, Massachusetts, Texas, and Virginia before we vote. So by the time we vote, it may narrow a little bit.
I think so, but we'll have more than two to choose from.
Yeah, we will have at least two, possibly more.
Probably at least four, I would think.
Yeah. Now, second on my list is the Trump administration's continuing immigration violations. That's going to continue to be a big news story. The courts have been ruling against the Trump administration, but the Trump administration has not been responding to those rulings. It's going to be an open question, I think, of who can ultimately punish the Trump administration and hold them accountable for the horrendous constitutional violations
that brings us to impeachment. Which I think Nancy Pelosi has been very smart to hold up conveying the articles of impeachment to the Senate. And they've been talking now about, well, we can always add additional articles of impeachment, because every week that those articles get held up, we find out more constitutional violations by the Trump administration.
And impeachment was number three on my list of big stories in the new year. Like it or not, we're going to be hearing more about it. There's going to be more stuff coming forward, and it's going to be a continually evolving crisis. Number four is the slowing economy. Going into a presidential race, nothing matters more to voters than their pocketbooks and the economy. But the economy is slowing because of the combination of Trump's failed tax cuts, which have been increasing the budget deficit to record levels, and his doubly failed trade war, which is impacting and causing a slowing in the manufacturing sector to levels that we haven't seen since 2009, when the country was trying to get out of an economic recession.
Yeah, it's been a problem both for agriculture and for supply chain for manufacturing.
Yeah.
And I would say that, you know, that's going to be an issue. And then, you know, if we see an ongoing spike in oil prices,
because
of what'll happen in the Middle East, that's going to be an impact globally. Mm-hmm. And that's going to impact on the United States economy too.
Yeah. So those are my top four.
All right. Let's jump to events.
So let's go to events then. As Job said, today is the National Day of Action, U.S. troops out of Iraq, and no war, no sanctions on Iran. That's a rally hosted by Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, and others.
There's six or seven different groups that have been organizing.
Yeah, that is just starting right about now from 2 to 3 p.m. at Victor Steinbrook Park at the north end of Pike Place Market downtown. Tomorrow is the rally against the 3%ers militia and their right-wing racist supporters. This is also a drive to collect winter clothing and gear for homeless folks. That's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. tomorrow at at City Hall, 600 4th Avenue at James Street downtown. Then Tuesday, January 7th, is the Port of Seattle Commissioners meeting. Come and testify against the construction of a third cruise ship terminal near Pioneer Square. That's hosted by Ish River Response, 350 Tacoma, and other environmental groups. That's from noon to 1 p.m. on Tuesday. Arrive at least 20 minutes early to sign up to speak. That's at Pier 69 at 2711 Alaskan Way at the foot.
I would say arrive like an hour early.
Yeah, that's at the foot of Clay Street, just a block south of Broad Street on the waterfront, Pier 69.
And anybody who's spent any time on the waterfront the last couple of years knows what an impact those cruise ships have. They overwhelm the downtown neighborhood, and the whole idea that you're going to redevelop the waterfront.
They produce a lot of water pollution because they dump their sewage untreated into the waters of Puget Sound, and they also are not great for climate change.
That's all true.
Now, Wednesday, January 8th, is a vigil for patient safety and a fair union contract at Swedish Providence Hospitals. That's hosted by SEIU Healthcare 1199 NW from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Swedish Hospital branch nearest you. And that includes the Broadway branch, Cherry Hill, Ballard, Edmonds and Issaquah branches will all have those demonstrations. Friday, January 10th, is the rally at J.P. Morgan Chase to demand that they stop supporting fossil fuel companies. That's hosted by 350 Seattle and People's Echo. That's from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Friday. Gather at the Statue of Lenin at 3526 Fremont Place North in Fremont at 10 a.m. Saturday, next Saturday, is a legal observer training by the National Lawyers Guild. This is a training for activists who would like to become legal observers. That's from 10 a.m. to noon at the Capitol Hill branch of the Seattle Public Library at 425 Harvard at East Republican Street on Capitol Hill. And then also Saturday is the community forum to shut down the Northwest Detention Center, hosted by La Resistencia. That's from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. next Saturday at Washington Hall at 153 14th Avenue, about a block north of Yesler in the Central District.
And we've got your whole year planned out for you. It's going to be a busy year.
It is going to be a busy year.
So, yeah, start doing your push-ups now to prepare. Yeah.
And support your local volunteer independent media like KODX, because we rely on listener contributions.
Yes, go to our website at kodxseattle.org. We have a Patreon button at the top and a PayPal button at the bottom. Or you can send a check made out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to
P.O. Box 45883.
Seattle, Washington.
98145. And you see...
And thank you for your support.
Yes, yeah, very much so. And Maria and I could have memorized that address a long time ago, but we want to give Mike a chance to shine.
Yeah. Okay, so where's the doggy snap? I got it right this time. All right, so we'll plan on seeing you both next, this same time next week.
That's the plan.